My name is Mary Jane Verrett, and I am 52 years old. Today's date is March the 6th, 2008, and I'm in San Antonio, Texas. And I'm going to be interviewing my mother, Betty Mozagamba, and my aunt, Mary Margaret Inselman.
My name is Mary Margaret Isaacs Inselman, a.k.a. Aunt Ouija. My age is 69. Today's date is March 6, 2008. I'm in San Antonio, Texas, and my relationship to the partner is my niece, Mary Jane Verrett.
This is Betty Jane Isaacs Mozagamba. I'm 81 years old. Today's date is March the 6th, 2008. This location is San Antonio, Texas, and I am the sister to Mary Margaret Inselman and the mother to Mary Jane Verrett.
Okay, so today we're going to talk about my grandmother, who was a major, is just a remarkable person who meant so much to all of us as we were growing up. And so I wanted to get together today and talk about my grandmother. Her name was Genevieve Isaacs, and to all of us, she was known as Jane. And my mother is the oldest of five girls. And I thought first question I would ask you is to tell me, what does Jane look like to you?
Well, she was about 5'5", medium build, had brown hair until she got old. Then she had white hair. And she had a very lively personality.
And how did you see her, Ouija?
Well, I see the same physical makeup. I see a bundle of energy that had almost a bottomless pit of compassion and energy and enthusiasm for life. That's my memory.
When I see Jane, I see her eyes. I see her beautiful eyes. Ah! Okay. Do you ever still dream about Jane?
Yes, I do. I still have certain memory pieces that will come to me at the oddest times in my dreams. Usually it is an action movie. She was always on the move, and we were always doing all kinds of things. So every once in a while, I will see something that probably sticks in my subconscious, and then it'll come back and visit me at night. And that's a great thing.
Do you, Mom? You ever dream of Jane?
Occasionally, I do. And right after she died, I did quite often. But now I don't dream about it very often anymore. But occasionally, it comes to mind. Various little things that happened when I was a child, like when it snowed, when we lived on the south side, I was about 4 years old, we scooped up a bowl full of snow and put sugar and vanilla and some milk on it, and we ate it and called it ice cream, which was a fun thing to do.
And we still made ice cream later on. I mean, we actually made ice cream, I remember.
Yes, but this was just a child doing something.
Yeah. If you had to look back and ask yourself what your earliest memory is of your mother, what is that?
Well, when I was about four years old, I received a working electric stove, something which they wouldn't allow nowadays, and a working iron with an ironing board. So I would cook little dinners on my stove. But one day, I was determined I was going to cook some green beans, but I didn't want to snap them. So Mother said, "You go snap those green beans." And my aunt happened to be there at the time. And about that time, I said, "No, I don't want to." And about that time, the lightning struck and the thunder boomed. And she said, "See, that's what you get for not doing what you're supposed
mother.
To do."
So would that have been Aunt Rose? Aunt Rose?
Mother said that.
But Aunt Rose was the aunt.
She was there, and she was listening to it, and she says, "See, you don't do what you're told to do, then it thunders and lightning." And eventually I did snap the green beans and cook them on my little stove. Of course, nowadays they wouldn't allow that. A child might get hurt, but I didn't ever get hurt.
And you eat?
Well, you know, this is funny. I remember her as I was probably about 6. It was during the summer. She had an enormous garden that was a lot of work to overturn. They would spade it all up and work in the compost that she had been cooking all winter. And there were some Mexican men that worked for my father, or with my father, who would come out there. One was Joe Garcia. There was Little Joe, and there was Medium Joe. And they would come, and it was a blast of fun. It was during the very early spring, and we got to build a bonfire, burning up all the rubbish and etc., and we got to put toast on a stick and eat burned toast. That was pretty exciting. And of course, they had the faucets. My father would take the turn on or off of the faucets, because we were known for letting a lot of water go to waste. So he had taken them, and they would always screw them back on again when they got ready to use them. Well, somebody, and it wasn't me, took that turner offer and misplaced it. So I got blamed for it, even though I know I was innocent. And so I was sent to my room, and I was watching out the upstairs window, just crying like mad. So Jane went outside, and she burned me a piece of toast and brought it up to me.
Aww.
It really didn't make me feel better, but at least I got a piece of burned toast.
Do we know how we started calling her Jane to begin with? I don't even know.
Now, the story behind that was she was called Jenny by her family, as a, you know, a nickname for Genevieve.
Yeah.
And then when we went to school, we were at Ursuline Academy, and she was very active in the PTA, and the people there didn't know her nickname of Jenny. So because she was Genevieve, somebody shortened it. It was a friend of hers shortened it to Jane. And that was probably I was probably 5 or 6 at that time when I got ready to go to school. So that's how she got Jane, and she stayed that way.
Yeah, I always think it's kind of weird that we all called her Jane instead of, I never thought of calling her grandmother or grandma or anything else.
And you know, we call my father grandpère because when I was in college, I was taking French, and you were little, and Robbie was little. And I was always trying to teach you kids French. Of course, none of it worked. And I don't believe anybody says anything in French today, not even me. But I called grandpère, and it stuck. And you kids all called him that.
Yeah.
But we never called her grandmère.
When you think about the best times that we had, I have to think of the holidays. So tell me about what your fondest memory is of the holidays. It's got to be Christmas first, but Easter second, I think. Talk about Christmas, Mom.
Well, I think of Christmas when I was about 4 years old, and we were still living on the South Side, and I got a precious little dollhouse for Christmas. And I was so elated over it, and it had all the little furniture and all the little people, and I was just having the greatest time. A few days later, we went over to visit my parents' friend, Dutch Meyer, and they had a little girl called Rosalie, and she had a dollhouse, but hers had electric lights. And, oh, I was so devastated because mine didn't have electric lights, and her lamps in her dollhouse would light up, and I thought I got gypped. But in another time, I got a lot of dolls. And when we moved to the north side, well, before we moved, I had a little dollhouse. I mean, not a dollhouse, a playhouse. It was about 5 foot tall and had two windows and a front door, and it had shutters on the windows. And I was so proud of that little house. And so I carried all my dolls out there and all the furniture, and I just had the greatest time. But when we moved to the north side, of course, they carried up my little dollhouse, and I played in it quite a while. But the first thing you know, my father decided to slaughter a pig. We had two piglets, and they grew pretty big. So he slaughtered one of the pigs. And I went off. I was sent off to the neighbors to play while they did the dirty deal. And when I came back, there was a little fire going on in my playhouse, and they were smoking the hams.
Smoking your pig?
In my little playhouse.
The pig?
But I lived over it. But it was an interesting thing.
Was that out in the country at that time?
At that time,
Clower Street
was in the country. We were the only house at the end of the street, and the street was graveled, and there was no houses beside us, none in front of us, and the closest house was in the next block.
And now Clower would be really considered inner city in San Antonio.
Almost.
Yeah. So, I guess when I, and so that was a big piece of property then. Was it always that large? I mean,
no,
was that
it was not. They had just the one lot in the house. Well, they tried to buy the lot next door, but they never could find the person. But they finally did, and this woman had to give them a quick claim deed because there was no other paper or document available,
mm-hmm.
the one that was in her name. So they got a quick claim deed from her, and then that's when Mother planted the big garden. And that's when they had the rabbit hutches and the chickens and all this kind of good stuff. In later years, the two lots between the street and their house were purchased by my grandparents, and they built a house and had chicken yards and all that kind of good stuff in it.
Oh, so that's when Nanny was on the corner. They bought that house then after y'all had already lived there for a while.
They built that house there.
Oh.
It wasn't there before.
I think it was right after the war. Our uncle was able to appropriate enough building supplies to actually build the little house.
Oh.
And they moved over here then because they were both in declining health. And I think that house was built around 1947.
And at that point, how many... Is this when all five of you had already been born?
No, I was already gone.
Oh, when that house was built?
I was already gone by that time.
So the Chandlers that were on the other side of the street, they were there though when you were growing up.
Yeah,
right?
They were always there. And we bought milk from them when our cow was dry. They had cows also, and we went and bought milk from them when ours were dry.
Did Mrs. Chandler always bake bread? Was that something? I remember her
baking
bread when I grew up.
Yeah, she always baked bread. Occasionally, she had a big garden. Occasionally, she would give us things out of her garden, and we'd give her some out of ours.
How was it during the Depression?
Well, the Depression was previous to that time.
Yeah.
The Depression was when we lived over on the South Side. And my father, who was an operating engineer, he made $200 a month. For all of us. And the house we lived in, I believe, was rented. But in later years, maybe about 1930 or 31 maybe, then they bought the house out in the country on Clower Street. And they paid a whole $6,000 for it. And so we moved out there, and it had only water, electricity, and phone. There was no gas and no septic, no sewer system. So we had a septic tank and we cooked with kerosene. We had to cook on the stove. We had to warm water on the stove for a bath. And the house needed a lot of work, which Father did over time because he generally worked from 3 to 11. So he did all this work around the house. He put the fence up around the house. It had no fence when we moved there, but it turned out very nicely, but it was a long time doing.
When I think of Christmas, I think of just when the family was all together, and we were just, it was just so marvelous, because Jane loved holidays, and she loved Christmas, and she loved to celebrate, and I think she loved to cook and she loved to garden and she loved to sew. But so I don't know which memory sticks out the most.
Well, I think the celebration Christmas was her favorite. Easter was close behind, but Christmas was really a big thing. About 4 weeks before Christmas, 4 to 5 weeks before Christmas, as long as I lived here and even after I moved back, if I would come back to San Antonio from Dallas, we would make the fruit cakes, and that was a all-day project. We baked them all in these all kinds of shapes and sizes, big ones and little pound ones and 5 pound ones, and it was all day long. And I got to decorate the tops of them with candied fruit and the nuts and all this business. And then when they were all done, they were baked in wax paper, and then we'd slide that off and we'd sop it all with bourbon. And then wrap them in cloths and put them in that buffet drawer, the buffet that you own now.
The buffet that I have now.
And I bet you if I sniffed them, I bet I could still smell bourbon and fruitcakes in the bottom of it. But that would be our beginning. That was the starting gun was the fruitcake baking. And then we would plan, and we had a set menu for Christmas. Every year it was the same thing. I don't think we varied it. Maybe I think green bean casserole was added after a while. But
what was the menu for Christmas?
The menu was always a turkey dressing that she made the best dressing in the whole wide world. It was cornbread dressing. I remember going with my father out to a turkey farm where they had white turkeys, and we would pick out the turkey. I always got the willies about that. But the last year that she made a turkey, that turkey weighed 48 pounds
dressed.
Oh,
my God. How'd they cook it?
And so it took, we couldn't stuff it. We just baked it plain in the oven. We took out all the shelves in the oven and just put a grate at the bottom and put that huge turkey in there. And then Christmas, we started it the night before. It took so long to bake. And so then the next morning, my dad and my husband had to lift that turkey out of the oven. It weighed a ton.
Oh, my word.
It was really fantastic. And then we always had ambrosia, which is a very southern thing that she had to have no matter what. It was oranges, cherries, and pineapple.
And
that was a big deal about that.
Oh, I remember the ambrosia.
Oh, yes. Ambrosia was a big thing. And she always had a bowl of eggnog by the front door. And she put a little spike in it, and it always had nutmeg on it, and all the little cups were around there. And that was a big thing. She liked to have that glass of eggnog. And then, of course, it was the green beans and sometimes squash, and it was always this gorgeous cauliflower from her garden.
The garden was such a part of our lives growing up.
That's right.
All of the grandkids worked in it, and were there 17 grandkids, I'm thinking?
Yeah. And she would take these cauliflower and wrap the leaves up around the top so the cauliflower stayed beautiful and white. And she always made a cheese sauce, and the cauliflower heads all had to be whole. And we would drag out our grandmother's and great-grandmother's dishes. We had to use everything we had in the place.
Oh, yeah.
Well, there was a big dining room table, and normally only the adults were in there. And then as children got a little older, every once in a while, one of them would get to sit in there. And my children remember sitting there when they were 14. And that was the biggest thing in their life. And she always served wine, red wine with the dinner. And the children always got grape juice in a crystal glass. They thought that was really uptown.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
Yeah. So, but then we had the big opening of the presents, and we had
we always had someone as Santa Claus that came from down from upstairs, that came from grandparents' bedroom, that came downstairs and delivered the presents to everybody and did the ho ho ho. It's funny when looking back.
Your cousin Robbie did it for the last few years.
But who did it before? The Uncle Don.
Uncle Don did it,
and that was
and
pretty
he did
special.
It first.
And Uncle Billy would come visit on Christmas, and that was always quite the la-di-da because it was Uncle Billy and Aunt Dorothy. And
yeah, sometimes she came. Not too often did she
not
come.
Not very often. Uncle Billy came by himself.
And then we would have the opening of the presents. That was a big thing. Jane made most of the gifts that she gave to our children.
She was an extraordinary seamstress.
Oh,
really.
Unbelievable. And the long gowns, flannel gowns, that got to be a big thing. My girls still have their flannel gowns. And she, one of my daughters is tall, and she would always make that gown long enough for it to sweep the floor for her because she liked it long. And it's just little things like this that was so important to her, to all of these
kids. To all of our family. Well, yes, because I remember when I got married, we looked around for my wedding dress, and we looked and we looked and we looked, and then finally I just said, Jane, would you please make my wedding dress? And she did, and I feel very fortunate for that because she sewed and sewed all those little pearls, and truly, I feel so fortunate to have had that. And I remember she sewed Aunt Sing's clothes for, as a school teacher, she always dressed very, very professional manner. And
well, Jane, she made Rosemary's wedding dress, too. I don't remember about Tricia.
Well, the we made my senior prom dress, too. It was a short dress of Chantilly lace, and she and I sewed beads and pearls on that for 4 months.
Oh, my Lord.
And it was just an exquisite dress, and I still have that dress today. I got it out a few years ago and held it up to me, and it covered exactly half of me, the width. But that was okay. I still have it. So my granddaughter wants to wear that dress for her senior prom, and I'll probably have to alter it for her because she's little. But Christmas was just such a magical time. Then we'd have the gift opening, and every year your father would take a nap on the sofa, and then we'd play tricks on him. We'd put a toy on his lap or something, always, and then generally it was warm, and they'd go outside and play football.
Yeah, I remember we always played sports outside. And the, I guess looking back with all the grandkids, we were so fortunate to have been able to share that time together. I remember Easter was so great at Mom, when you would have the Easter egg dyeing party for everybody. I don't know how you put up with all of us.
That was so Mother could have a peaceful Saturday so she could get ready for Sunday.
Well, then after a while, I didn't go to the egg dyeing party. I would help Mama. And it was always my job to make the twice-baked potatoes. And you can't imagine what it's like to make twice-baked potatoes for that many people. I don't know how many pounds of those things we did, but it seemed to me like it was endless. And then at the same time, your brother John would always bring a whole lot of fish down, and we would light the big barbecue in the back. And we would smoke venison and ham and turkey on that big barbecue. And then John bought down these fish, and we smoked fish outside. That's the first time I'd ever smoked fish, and it was wonderful. So, and the brother-in-laws would all come over there during that afternoon. Maybe not all afternoon, but they'd come, and they'd have a little drink of beer or something out in the back while they were barbecuing. But Daddy and I would light that fire about 5 o'clock in the morning, and then that barbecue pit was absolutely perfect. It was insulated well, and he had a big grate on there, and we could cook all the meat. And then we would refrigerate it, and the next morning we'd start cutting it. And the most remarkable thing about it, we had one little nephew that was, he was challenged, but he always remembered the holiday by the menu. He'd come saying, "Is this twice-baked potato holiday?" And I'd say, no, that's not till Easter. Oh, okay, well then, this is turkey and dressing day. And yes, it is. So he remembered the holiday by that set menu.
Oh, how funny. Clearly we're a family that revolves around food.
Yeah. And all the kids at the Easter dyeing party would try to excel who would do the best-looking egg. Oh. Then we carried them all on Sunday morning to Mother's house, and we had them set up on a table, and we had 3 judges over who did the best-looking Easter egg. And there'd be all sorts of arguments about that, but eventually they would get them judged.
But then nobody wanted to judge because they didn't want to be, you know.
Everybody mad at them.
Yeah, everybody mad at them. And I still have one egg that was in the egg dyeing party that I put out at Easter. I've got it in a big nest of packing to save it. And then I put it out at Easter every year.
John remembers that very well because he was one of the judges.
Yeah. Well, you know, what a difference in our times then, because then we were able to judge. Nowadays, everybody would get a prize and everybody would be first place, I guess. Well, our society is now. But
at the Easter egg hunt, we would have prizes in the eggs. We would have little numbers to pick up prizes in the kitchen. All sorts of things like that to be an incentive to hunt for the Easter eggs.
I remember the year that Jane hid the egg, the big high dollar egg. I remember she hid that in the bird feeder, and it was a big deal when we got the.
It had $5 in it.
It had $5.
That was in the gold egg, and then the silver egg had a buck in it.
And one of them was hidden in the old commode.
Yes.
Yeah, really? Father had redone the bathroom, and there was an old commode sitting out in the back, and one egg was hidden in there.
Well, okay, so this leads me to tradition, because I think Jane established many traditions for us, and really, I think, talk to us about how if you don't know where you're going if you don't know where your roots are. And I think she was always very proud of her Irish heritage. And so why don't we talk about your trips to Ireland and how that came about?
Well, I think one thing you had to realize that Mother came, her roots were very deep, and her Christopher Hammond, who was on her father's side, fought in the American Revolution, and he was a very strong advocate. And then her mother came from County Antrim, and he was, in a way, John Gibson was kind of a rebellious person because he was against the British for overcoming their society. So he decided that he was going to pick up and move to Texas like his brother did. Well, he got quite a large inheritance when his father died, and as the oldest boy, he was entitled to the property. But he gave the property to his younger brother, and he packed up and moved to Texas. And he came to Texas on a freighter-type ship that sailed away from Belfast. And it was had a lot of commodities like sugar and whatnot, and they went by the way of Cuba. And while they were going that way, one of her brothers ate a lot of the sugar and was very sick because he ate too much. But then they came along, and then they docked at Galveston. Well, John Gibson went into Brazoria County and bought a large acreage, which was reputedly to be 800 acres. Well, he was not familiar with the laws of Texas and whatever, because he thought if he had a deed, he had the property. But he did not realize it had to be recorded. But another friend of his was there at the same time, and he said, "I'll take it to be recorded." Well, he never made it to the recording. Who knows why? So therefore, when John Gibson died abruptly of pneumonia, then Sarah Gibson, his wife, had no claim. So she had to move out of the property, and she went to work cooking for the railroad gang. And she took her little children and went into Ennis, Texas, and they cooked for the railroad people all the time. Eventually, she got to Houston, and my grandmother, Rose Gibson, went to secretarial school, and she became the secretary to the mayor of Houston. And she was a little bit of a person and a very interesting person. And eventually, she married Benjamin Hammond, who was brother to the sheriff of Harris County. So I guess that's how she met him. Well, Benjamin Hammond was the opposite of Rose Gibson. He was a big, husky man, a very vocal-type person, very strong-willed, and Rose Gibson was a neat little person. So she had many children, and she enjoyed them all. But she did not have any multiple births, but her mother, Sarah Gibson, had at one time had twins and had triplets, but it never came through the rest of the family. So eventually, Rose Gibson, they lived there on Lee Street. I remember when Grandpa Hammond died of diabetes. It's over?
No, we have 10 minutes.
When Grandpa Hammond died of diabetes, I must have been about maybe 5 or 6 years old. And I remember it very well because he slept in a little bedroom off the main house. And no.
Well, you know, I think we translated her love of Ireland and all of her Irish ancestry. She was very, very proud of all this. And she always wanted to go to Ireland. And the year, 2 years after she died, Betty called me and said, "We're going to Ireland." I said, "Oh, my, we're going to Ireland." So she had done all the genealogy research and found a cousin who lived in Northern Ireland. So we made the reservations. Bob, my husband, and Betty and I were going. Well, the night before we were ready to leave, the travel agency called and said, "It's very dangerous there. We will give you all your money back. Don't worry about it. Just cancel. Don't go." Well, poor old Bob was scared half to death. Betty didn't have good sense, and I was going, "Oh, boy, that's an adventure. I want to go." So we off we go, and it was absolutely a riot. We rented a car in Dublin and headed north, and as we crossed the border, we all had our passports because we'd just gotten checked in Dublin.
Yeah.
And so there was a blockade there of all these half trucks and all these British soldiers with bayonets attached. And Bob is saying, "Oh, baby, where's my passport?" Well, I don't know where his passport is, but we saw them strip down the car in front of us and strip this man, and we were a little anxious.
I remember we were just anxious about y'all going.
Oh, yeah. And they all had camouflage on their face and stuff. And Bob said, "Betty, we are in a war zone." And she said, "Oh, Bob, just look. They have their faces painted green. It's for Ireland." Bob said, "That is not for Ireland. That is for warfare. We are in the middle of it." So by the time they pulled us up, they were going along the hedgerows, sticking those bayonets right in there, looking to see if anybody's in the hedgerow. But they pulled us up. He took one look at us and just waved us on.
And I guess you just look so American. Well, as I recall, Uncle Bob had on a cowboy hat, and that was the year that on the TV show Dallas, JR had been shot. And so everybody was quite interested in the Texans.
Oh, they were.
And who shot JR.
Yeah, who shot JR. And I said, well, we made it through that one. And it was really very uneventful. We did see soldiers that first year. I think we went in 1982, and there was still a certain amount of conflict there. But it never really touched us. People were extremely friendly and generous with their time. You know, if you asked directions, they would not just give you directions. They'd take you there. But we did go and meet our cousin. Now, I must tell you a little bit about Arthur. I would love to have Jane to have met him, because he was a unique character, and he reminded me a lot of her. He was very, very much to the point, no messing around. So it was just a wonderful trip, and the whole time we were there, we talked about Jane being on our shoulder.
Yeah, I think Jane would have loved it, and I think she is there. I mean, there are times for me when I'm very sad that I know she's with me.
Oh, yeah. She doesn't leave us. Never has.
And I guess if I had to look at all my cousins, and if we had to sum it up and we had to say, what did Jane mean the most to us, or what was it that was so special about Jane? What was her one defining quality for every grandchild? What would you say that is?
It had to be, as I asked my children about her, two of the boys said, she made each grandchild feel so important. They were the only grandchild she had, no matter what it was. And I thought that was so profound. The one kid that said this is a judge, so I expected something profound out of him. The other one is an entrepreneur kind of person, and he said, you know, I just felt so important with Jane. And I think that that is the thing that guided each one of those children back to that 1115 Clower Street all the time, because that was where they felt so very important.
When you look back, what would you say is, what is it that you most miss about Jane?
Excuse me?
What is it that you most miss about your mom?
Well, that she always came up with a solution for something. If whatever was going wrong, she'd find a way around it. Except she didn't get around the night this young Aggie asked me to take me for a Coke after a performance at Ursuline, and he was a very nice young man, and I asked, Mother and Daddy happened to be at the performance, and I asked if I could go, and they asked who else was going, and I said my friend Ann was going with this other boy. Okay, well, then I could go. So off we went. But my friend Ann evidently didn't like the boy she was going with, so she didn't go. So when we drove up at my house, my father was waiting at the door, and he said, you lied to me. Ann didn't go with you. So needless to say, I never saw the Aggie again. However, he ran out of gas 2 blocks from our house, and Daddy had to give him 4 gallons of gas so he could get back home.
Well, he wanted to get rid of him. Well, if we had to sum it up, how would we sum it up when we look back on Jane's life and say, what would we want people to know about Jane?
That she was an exceptional person with an exceptional spirit that influences all of us to this day. And most of the grandkids. Some of the grandkids didn't know her very well, so perhaps they were not touched, but the older ones all revered her.
To this day, I would say.
Yeah, I think I would have to say her spirit, her enthusiasm, and her love of life, no matter what it was, she was going to enjoy it. She had an enormous amount of energy. She produced huge garden goods. She had a sense of charity about her. We all were assigned duties by her to bring stuff to the clinic that she supported in Westside San Antonio. I came home with a trunk of clothes and food every single time I came. I collected used children's clothes because they had a great need for that.
Oh, yeah, that's because we always donated that.
That's right.
And I remember her always telling me, you know, when something didn't go too well with one of the family members, she would go, one makes allowances for family.
That is exactly right. So and her sense of charity was a very, very important part of her life. And no matter who it was, it didn't make any difference. She would find a way to help everybody that walked in that door.
Well, to quote John, my oldest son, he says, her home was memories of fun and family when it was good. I remember being an Aggie in the Corps and her wanting to be a part of it by giving me some help in getting my senior boots and spurs.
Oh, yeah.
So that was a fun thing.
And even though, right, it was only a few days before she died, she came to my graduation from college.
Well, and a few days before she died, I came to Dallas. I came from Dallas to San Antonio, and her very love was chocolate. And I stopped at the Russell Stover's and bought 4 pieces of chocolate, which were against the rules.
It was more than that.
Well, I only gave her 4. I think I ate 4. But I thought, you know, that's what she wanted. And she ate 4 pieces of chocolate.
I said, heck, give it to her.
Yeah, so we did, because that's what she wanted. And, you know, I believe that you need to give what people want, not necessarily what they want, but what they need. No, not what they need, but what they want. And that's what she did to all of us. She gave us a fill-in of all of our needs and wants. I don't care what it was. We found a way to enjoy every minute with her.
And on her 100th birthday, on her tombstone, we hung a huge floral wreath and gave her a good drink of scotch.
Yes,
now, you didn't drink it,
her.
Betty. Don't say that you drank any of it. I did the drinking.
I said we gave her a good report.
Oh, yeah,
I
poured some of the stone, and I toasted her. And each year we do the cemeteries.
And we
I take a scotch, and I toast her every time. By the end of the day, I'm in pretty good shape.
And that's another tradition that will live on forever.
Yeah. So we do that every year, and that's a great memory thing too. And each of our children have been down here with me to help me decorate, and we drive around. And we encompass some of my husband's family as well in the old German cemetery.
Well, that's just taking that sense of charity and that sense of community and of family and carrying it out throughout.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much for allowing us to tell our story.
She's ready for us to quit.
Okay. I think so.
I think we've talked enough, Betty.
Thank you.